The next thing, and the third most important thing, is having your spine correct for you. There are a lot of people in this world who've damaged their backs. I didn't know how many until I ran a monastery. The monastery is not supposed to make you unnatural, strange, weird. It is not supposed to make you ill. Have a straight spine. Yes, if you are in perfect health, then your spine should be as a perfectly healthy spine should be, which is slightly S-shaped. That is, for the sake of the books, a straight spine. If you have a slightly fused spine or a damaged spine, hold it as perfectly as you can. One of the beauties of the eternal is he does not hold against us the fact that we've done damage to ourselves. And remember, the purpose of this exercise is to find the eternal. It is not to look good sitting on the floor. There are those I know in the East, and I've met some of them, who insist that everybody sits like a bunch of ramrods and it looks terrific, but you want to feel the atmosphere in there. You can almost cut the pain with a knife. Maybe that's good for some, but certainly in Soto Zen, we didn't find it worked. And we knew what we were trying to do. We were trying to become one with the eternal. That being so, find the way that it is right for you to sit. And as we get older, we have to face the fact that our bones don't twist up nearly as simply as they did when they were younger. There is a beautiful piece, often neglected by present day teachers, in every single ceremony involving both laymen and monks, which says very clearly, if a trainee is old, he should be allowed to sit as is best for him. If a trainee is coming to be ordained and he is old, he does not necessarily have to do all the bows or all the actions listed in the ceremony. The accent is always on compassion. You are there to find the eternal, to do the finest you possibly can. That's your purpose. That it makes a neat and beautiful ceremony is nice when you've got a 20-year-old who's got the world's prize figure and can hop up and down and look good. That's great. I'm sure the eternal loves it. But when you're in your 60s and your legs don't work so good, the eternal is just as overjoyed. Do not think that this is going to make a difference. Above all, do not think that this is going to make a difference. Because the purpose you are there for is to find the eternal. Now, having realized that you put your spine in the very best way you can, next, try and line up your head with your shoulders. So wherever your head is, it is weightless on the body. It is important that it does not feel heavy. For one, that will be one position, and for another, it will be a different one. Very slightly so. The way you make sure that the hands are weightless is you put one over the other. And these two thumbs, if they press against each other, you will tense up your shoulders. This looks like a useless thing to ask people to do, But if they're only touching lightly, you will not tense up anywhere around here. And the Zen master or the teacher, as he comes round, can look at your thumbs, and if he sees the nails have gone white, he knows that you're pressing. And then he can stop you being tense. People have often said, oh, how wonderful, you knew just what was wrong with me. No, you told us what was wrong with you. Well, how did I tell you? I didn't say a word. Well, you get a couple of bright white thumbs. And you know damn well what's wrong with the person. All sorts of things like this will give you warnings as to what not to do. All of the strange ways that people sit are for that purpose. Now, if you can't twist your legs up, don't get miserable about it. Remember that the Egyptians did some wonderful meditation sitting on chairs. Really exquisite meditation. Interestingly enough, they also had lotuses as one of their symbols, as one of their main symbols. You often had the newborn creature sitting in a lotus, just as in Buddhism. So remember, you can sit just as easily on a chair. But if you do sit on a chair, make sure that it is a big seated chair. Do not make it one on which you can fall off. In the early days when you meditate, you can get sleepy. Especially if you are alone. The advantage, as I've said many times, of sitting on the floor is you can't fall off it. You want to be in a place where you are safe and you are not going to hurt yourself. I know of somebody on one occasion who was sitting on a chair. She was incredibly thin, fell off one side and cracked a rib. So I'm not falling on this. You've got to be careful. Make sure that you have a nice wide-bottomed bench or stool so that if you fall, your elbow is going to catch with something and wake you up. It is best not to have a back, but it doesn't matter. You should sit forward on the chair so that the back of the thighs are not restricted with regard to blood flow. If you can sit on the floor, there are a number of ways to go that I'll get our friends to demonstrate just before we do the actual meditation. But above all, if you sit the Burmese, which is one in front of the other, remember that you'll pull your back out of whack if you always do it the same way. You can either change halfway through each period of sitting, or do one the morning this way and the evening this way. But whatever you do, don't always do it the same way, because I pulled my back out of whack that way. I know what I'm talking about. So, to go back to where we were on page 158, they were speaking of the precepts as not killing, not stealing, not coveting, not saying that which was untrue, not selling the wine of delusion, not speaking against others, not being proud of oneself and devaluing others, not being mean in giving either teaching or money, not being angry, and not debasing the three treasures. There are one or two here that you need to look at. First of all, do not steal. In its original form was not to take that which is not given. There's a lot of difference between stealing and taking that which is not given. A lot of things are not given. Saying that which is untrue. In Christianity and Judaism, you have don't bear false witness. Buddhism says do not say that which is untrue. Now, the basis, this thing actually is the basis of the reason for not asserting that we know what God or what the eternal is. We can say what we know it is not. If we say what we know it is before we have actually found it, we could be saying something that is untrue, and therefore breaking this particular precept. So do not say that which is untrue. We know it is unborn, undying, uncreated, unchanging. We know that. Anything else we say can only ever be opinion, unless we have proved it absolutely true. So you see, it goes one step further than lying. Just as stealing goes one step further than stealing, don't take that which is not given, so the one on lying goes one step further than lying. Don't say that which is untrue. If you always got your brain in gear not to say that which is untrue, you are very unlikely to lie. You are very unlikely to lie at all, because you are trying to be strictly truthful. There is a different emphasis here. It presumes that the trainee loves the eternal. There's an old saying about St. Bernadette, who, when being questioned, and she was regarded as being very thick in the head, when being questioned as to what a sinner was, her answer was, "Oh, that's very easy. It is one who loves evil." Note, it's not one who does, one who loves evil. And a person who is training to observe the precept of not saying that which is untrue is a person who loves truth, as a person, as opposed to a person who is trying to avoid lying because of the consequences. And there's a big difference between those two. A very big difference. Just as a person who is trying to refrain from taking that which is not given is worlds apart from a person who is trying not to steal. Much further along. A much more positive attitude of mind is required. It is also true on the one with regard to killing, because that is to refrain from taking life. You can kill a lot of things. You can kill a man's reputation. You can kill his joy. You have to start thinking carefully about killing. You are much further along here than it might have first appeared. Selling the wine of delusion is one of the ones that gives you the key to what is really going on. When we delude ourselves about something, we are someone who is drunk. Drunk with our own theories and our own opinions and our own ideas. do not cause others to become inebriated. Do not sell the wine of delusion. Yes, don't get drunk. Because obviously, then your brain is befuddled. But on a much, much deeper level, do not sell your own delusions and befuddle other people's minds, which takes drinking away from merely drinking to a lot further along the line. And this is how you have to think of all the precepts, in a very different light from what perhaps you thought of them before. Makes you much more thoughtful, much more spiritually adult, and much more attentive to what you are actually doing. And when you have understood them from this positive angle, you become very, very free. And there is very great joy, because then you can start leaving them as such alone. And of course it doesn't mean to say you can't have a glass of wine with dinner. That's not what we're talking about. And of course it doesn't mean to say that if you go out to dinner and somebody has made you a beautiful meal, it doesn't mean that you then cause the animal that was cooked to be killed in vain because you refuse to eat it. It does mean that you will point out to them, if you're a vegetarian, that in future you would prefer not to be served meat, but you then bless the animal and eat it, and that's it. And so you come, you leave these 10 gradually further and further behind, leaving them as prohibitions of thou shalt not, taking them to something much deeper, much more beautiful, to refraining from that, taking that which isn't given, not messing up other people's brains, getting away from that, and then doing the possible and the very best you can. For when you get to this positive state with these precepts, you come to what are called the 3 pure precepts, which are cease from evil, do only good, and do good for others. Cease from evil is absolute. Do everything you can to prevent evil taking place. Do everything you can to prevent yourself from doing evil. Do everything you can to do good. The third one is the difficult one. Do good for others. Don't turn into a do-gooder. What it means is, do not set up actions and chain reactions that will cause other people to do evil and not to do good. Do not set up a situation that will only result in evil. Now, once you have got used to these 10 precepts and have really got to the positive side rather than to the side that holds you down, once you've got to this positive state, then you can ask, when you are faced with a really difficult question, well, am I going to cease from evil if I do a certain act? Am I going to do only good? Is this act going to be good for others, or will it cause others to do harm? If you can get a yes to each of those 3 questions, then the act is probably a darn good one, and you should go ahead and do it. If you can't get a yes to the first one, you definitely shouldn't do it. If you can't get a yes to the second one, you should look at it very carefully. If you can't get a yes to the third one, you should look at it very carefully. But sometimes there are situations where, in doing the best you can, yes, you are going to have to break a precept. Because to do something else will be much worse. Sometimes we do have to do harm. Not intentionally, very sadly, but we do sometimes have to do that which it were better was not done. I don't know if any of you ever watch program Hill Street Blues here on the TV, do you? Do you remember the new one this week of the, last week of the captain who didn't quite do something out of the top drawer and went off to confession afterwards? Do you remember? That was a case. It wasn't quite right, but you knew why, and anything else would have been wrong, and he recognized that it was wrong. Sometimes we have to do that, and then we have to take the consequences, as he did. It's a beautiful program. If you want to understand how to train in horrendous circumstances, it is for adults, this sort of thing. And in the end, when all else fails, you take refuge in the last of the precepts. You take the three refuges. You take refuge in the eternal, called the Buddha. You take refuge in what the eternal teaches, called the Dharma. You take refuge in those who know the eternal, called the Sangha, the priesthood. And having taken refuge in your own faith, and its teachings, and in those who teach it, then to do the very best you can, and leave the rest to the eternal. That is how it is done. There you have the 10 precepts, the 3 pure precepts, and the 3 refuges. So you start off with what are almost prohibitions. You become free of them as prohibitions because they become a joy when you see the good they are doing. And then, as you take deeper and deeper refuge within the eternal, now am I ceasing from evil? When you make that statement, you are taking refuge in the eternal. Am I doing only good? That is to take refuge in the eternal. Am I doing good for others? Is to take refuge in the eternal. So just by keeping the lowest of the precepts, you are taking refuge in the eternal. All the way from the most coarse to the most subtle. And when you have found this place, then you find the eternal. But along the road, there are many, many signposts showing you the way, telling you that you are doing the right thing. There are 4 signs of enlightenment, or 4 signs of beginning to know the eternal. For these are the 4 signs of the eternal. And in Buddhism, they are called the 4 wisdoms. Charity, tenderness, benevolence, and sympathy. Now you should know that charity is the opposite of covetousness. We make offerings, although we ourselves get nothing whatsoever. It doesn't matter that other people don't care. What matters is that we go on making the offerings. It doesn't matter. Just go on and on with your own training. Don't worry about other people. What matters is that you do your training. It does not matter what others do. If you do your training, they will see you gradually changing, and then they will want to be as you are. That is how the Zen Buddhist changes both himself and the rest of the world. He doesn't get out there and do something. He gets out there and does something about himself. He doesn't do anything to other people. There's a bumper sticker on my car. It says, don't just do something, sit there. It means what it says. There are too many people in this world that want to do something. Right, now go and sit there and find the eternal. Then you'll be able to do something. Because until you have found the eternal, the chances of your doing the right thing are not too great. You may do the right thing by luck, or simply because it's very obvious, but you might not. And all acts of great importance in the end have to be done from the knowledge of the eternal. We cannot do such things from ourselves. So, there is no need, this is page 159 now, there is no need to be concerned about how small a gift may be, so long as it brings true results. For even if it is only a single phrase or verse of teaching, it may be a seed to bring forth good fruit both now and in the hereafter. So the first sign of doing real training is getting on with it and not worrying about other people. Charity. Make offerings although you get nothing. Go on and on and on making offerings, and those offerings may also be to the eternal. Just go on and on and on. And maybe nothing shows. Just go on. And go on and go on through the aridity. This is the first sign. Charity. The offering of only one coin or a blade of grass can cause the arising of good, for the teaching itself is the true treasure, and the true treasure is the very teaching. We must never desire any reward, and we must always share everything we have. It is an act of charity to build a ferry or a bridge. And all forms of industry are charity if they benefit others. And that charity may be cleaning the house, looking after the children, going to work in a coal mine. There is no act that is not the act of a Buddha when it is done for the sheer joy of self and other. Do not look down on any industry or work at all. I can remember people, when I first went to the East, being very upset because the first jobs they were given were to sweep up the paths of the garden or to scrub the long corridor. And I was informed, as were others, but these are the acts of a Buddha. And one day, a number of the young monks were sick, and there were four of the perhaps greatest roshis of all Japan. One, with creaky knees, was cleaning the long corridor, and he did creak as he did it, but the way in which he did it was most interesting. He was loving it. And he said to me, you know, I never get a chance to do this with all those youngsters here. He was overjoyed to be able to do it. Understand that there is great joy in being able to do good for others. When one has really understood this. I can remember the old cook happily enjoying himself washing dishes. And several of his juniors were watching TV, and the old cook was happily washing his dishes. And if you'd asked him what he was doing, he'd have said, I'm washing dishes. But he was doing a lot more than washing dishes. It was much more enjoyable watching him wash the dishes than it was watching the TV. Depends how it is done and what is being done. If you understand charity properly. So that is the first sign. Just the joy of doing what has to be done. And not worrying if other people are taking any notice or appreciating it. To behold all beings with the eye of compassion and to speak kindly to them is the meaning of tenderness. If one would understand tenderness, one must speak to others whilst thinking that one loves all living things as if they were one's own children. By praising those who exhibit virtue and feeling sorry for those who do not, our enemies become our friends, and they who are our friends have their friendship strengthened. This is all through the power of tenderness. Whenever one speaks kindly to another, his face brightens and his heart is warmed. If a kind word be spoken in his absence, the impression will be a deep one. Tenderness can have a revolutionary impact upon the mind of man. The second sign, tenderness. By speaking kindly to those who are our friends and feeling sorry for those who do not follow in the path of virtue. You note it is not a matter of judging those who do not follow in the path of virtue. It's just feeling sorry that they do not follow in the path of virtue. I don't know how many of you know Marlowe's Faust. Have any of you read it? I'm sure some of you must. There's an interesting piece in that wherein Faust asks Mephistopheles what it is like in hell. And Mephistopheles' answer is, to be in hell is not to be able to behold God. And that is why the Buddhist feels sorry for those who do not exhibit virtue. While they do not exhibit virtue, while they do not know tenderness and compassion and charity, they do not know the eternal. And the only thing you can do for such a person is feel incredibly sorry for them. There can be no judging, only incredible sadness. To be in hell is not to know the eternal. Marlowe was brilliant in that piece. To understand tenderness in this way is to understand that a man who is showing spite or uncharitableness or cruelty is a man in hell. A man in torment. And whilst you may have to do something about it, it is not for you to either judge, nor to harm him or his reputation. It is your duty to to try and show him the meaning of tenderness and to show what the Eternal has done for you, so that he too will want the Eternal. That is the duty, and that is the showing of tenderness. If one creates wise ways of helping beings, whether they be in high places or lowly stations, one exhibits benevolence. No reward was sought by those who rescued the helpless tortoise and the sick sparrow, these acts being utterly benevolent. The stupid believe that they will lose something if they give up help to others, but this is completely untrue, for benevolence helps everyone, including oneself, being a law of the universe. Benevolence is also a sign of becoming one with the Eternal, for the Eternal is benevolent. I don't know how many of you, I do watch TV now and then, if any of you ever watched The Night They Raided Minsky's, there's a lovely line in that where the Jew says to the Christian, the very narrow-minded Christian, "Well, only a God who could tolerate me could possibly tolerate you." The Jew is running a striptease joint, and the Christian is mad as he can get because his daughter is working in it. But it's a very good point. Only a God that could tolerate me could possibly tolerate you. We should leave out the possibly, because that was judgmental. Only a God that can tolerate me can also tolerate you. That is the meaning of benevolence. The sun's provided for everyone. The air is provided for everyone. Everything is provided for everyone equally. If we create wise ways of helping all beings as much as we can, then what we are doing is trying to show that we wish to copy as much as possible the ways of the Eternal. So the third sign of enlightenment, the third sign of knowing the Eternal, is wanting to be like him. First of all, he gives non-stop and gets no results. Well, the Eternal does that all right. How many of us are grateful? We go on and on and on receiving, and how many of us are grateful? There is constant tenderness. And how many of us notice? There is constant benevolence. There are thousands of ways in which we are helped, with fresh air, with sun, with sleep, with good healthy bodies, with vegetables. All that you are doing, you see, by showing these, are also showing the signs that the Eternal itself shows to us. I say itself because I know that somebody is going to yell at me if I say himself. So I say himself, herself, or itself, and you choose which one you prefer, because I don't care two hoots. I really don't care on that score. But remember, the signs of enlightenment are being shown at all times, in all things. That is why the Zen master, when asked what is enlightenment, says, "Take a look at the tree. It's showing you benevolence. It's showing you shade. It's showing you perfume. It's cleaning your air. Wise ways of helping beings. It is showing you the eternal. Look at all of these things. You can show the eternal in anything if you look at it and see the four signs of enlightenment. Know what you are looking for. Know what it is you are trying to do. And when you do these things with joy in your heart, it is because you have met and know the eternal. And you want to be as it is. The fourth one, if one can identify oneself with that which is not oneself, one can understand the true meaning of sympathy. Take, for example, the fact that the Buddha appeared in the human world in the form of a human being. Sympathy does not distinguish between oneself and others. The Buddha appeared as us, the eternal appearing in man, proving that we can find the eternal within ourselves. The last of the four wisdoms. There are times when the self is infinite and times when this is true of others. Sympathy is as the sea in that it never refuses water from whatsoever source it may come. Only a God that can tolerate me can also tolerate you. The sea refuses no water from whatsoever source it may come. All waters may gather and form only one sea. That's one of the reasons I love the Chinese method of saying, well, which precept can you start with? Do the one you can start with and go with it. Don't try to do the one you know you're not really going to be able to make it with first time out. And when you've made it with one of them, you're going to enjoy it so much, you're probably going to chuck all the other stuff you don't like. Or that you've been doing. And that's the way it's done. The four signs of enlightenment. And when you are living in this joyful state, when the precepts no longer bind you because you have gone beyond their binding stage to their positive stage, when you are living from the spirit of the eternal within yourself, then nirvana is here and now, for that is what nirvana is. To be one with the eternal, not to be in hell because you have turned away. Dogen makes a last little comment at the end of this chapter. O you seekers of enlightenment, meditate deeply upon these teachings and do not make light of them. Give respect and reverence to their merit, which brings blessing to all living things. Help all beings cross over to the other shore. To change from this side, or the worldly, to the spiritual. We live in the world as if in the sky. The Buddhist blessing is exquisite. We live in the world as if in the sky, just as the lotus blossom is not wetted by the water that surrounds it. Pure and beyond the world is the spirit of the true trainee, O Holy Buddha. We take refuge in thee. You could say, O Holy God, or Holy Spirit, whatever. Words don't matter. Once you've found that place, words don't matter a bit.